Now, the one who protects us all from prattling prognosticators and perfidious pundits.
I say, America, stay out the bushes.
Look for the union label.
And to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the government.
From my cold, dead hands.
I'm concerned that if we don't impeach this president, he will get reelected.
It's time for the Alan Nathan Show. Here he is, the longest-running nationally syndicated centrist host in the country, Alan Nathan.
Welcome, everyone, to the Alan Nathan Show, the bastion of militant moderation, where we live by my dear friend Alan's noble creed. We want the Republicans out of our bedrooms, the Democrats out of our wallets, and both out of our First and Second Amendment rights. I'm John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News, your host today, as we once again watch the Epstein follies breaking loose in Washington. This is such a weird story that just keeps coming back like a chronic disease that will never go away. Jeffrey Epstein and his influence keeps returning to the headlines. And in this case, it's no mystery as to why. The Democrats panicked after their shutdown blew up in their faces. It didn't work out at all the way they wanted it to. They desperately needed to change the subject, and they decided to bring Jeffrey Epstein back. And of course, you know that in Democrat mythology, Jeffrey Epstein was Donald Trump's pedophile pimp. They're trying to build this idea that Trump was diddling underage girls and Jeffrey Epstein was providing them. And that's the only thing they want you to know about Jeffrey Epstein. They don't want you to think about anybody else that he was dealing with. They don't care about the evidence. To the contrary, they don't care that pretty much the only person who has spoken definitively on the record about all of this has cleared Trump of any involvement with Epstein. Nope, they keep trying to bring this back and make it an exclusively Donald Trump scandal. And every time the Democrats try to bring Epstein back, the cooler heads on the Democratic Party and among the left-wing commentariat warn them and say, guys, this guy's toxic and he has a huge aura that includes a lot of other people, a lot of them Democrats. This is really more of a Democrat scandal, although it's bipartisan. But there are more high-ranking Democrats that are suspiciously linked to Epstein than Republicans. And if they keep bringing it up, it's going to blow up on them. It's going to be like a landmine that goes off while they're trying to set it. And sure enough, the next victim has fallen in the Jeffrey Epstein scandal. And who is it but Larry Summers? Larry Summers, top-level Democrat, has now backed out of public life. He's gone completely dark. He put out an announcement today that he's so embarrassed and ashamed of the latest Epstein revelations that he was indeed seeing young women with Jeffrey Epstein's help, according to these messages that have been revealed, that he's going to just disappear. He's going to crawl into a hole. And if you read the media reports of this today, if you read all of the coverage, they invariably tell you that Larry Summers was the former president of Harvard. That's the only thing that they will tell you about Larry Summers. But that's ridiculous. Larry Summers was a high official in the Clinton and Obama administrations. This guy was as high up the totem pole as it goes before he wound up going to Harvard. That's what happened after he worked for them. But he was way high up in the ladder of power. He was Bill Clinton's Treasury Secretary for a couple of years. And he also worked in the Obama administration as his top economic advisor in the White House. This brings Jeffrey Epstein to the doorsteps of Barack Obama and Bill Clinton. There's no way around it. And the only way around it is to do what the media is doing right now, as they try to protect the Democrats from the fallout from this nuclear bomb that they've set off. Is that they're just telling you, oh, Larry Summers, yeah, he was at Harvard or something. Mumble, mumble, mumble. And that's all they'll say about it. But this is just incredible to watch this thing detonate on them in the way that it has been. And now they're going into damage control mode over this. Another Democrat name that has become very intimately tied with Jeffrey Epstein is Representative Stacey Plaskett. She is very obscure. You may not recognize the name. She's the non-voting representative from the U.S. Virgin Islands. But she is a Democrat. She's a member of the Democrat Party. And we're finding out from these texts that have been revealed that Epstein was literally driving her around like a robot. She was in these congressional hearings in 2019 when the Democrats were trying to make hay over Epstein and get Trump. So they were holding these hearings. and she was at the hearings asking questions. And it turns out Epstein was literally watching the hearings on television and using his phone to tell Plaskett what to say. He was driving her around like a meat puppet. And she's a top Democrat. You know, she's Virgin Islands non-voting representative, but she's definitely a big Democrat, and she's a big outspoken one. And now she's linked in to the Epstein disaster. I mean, this is exactly what the doomsayers foretold when the Democrats started trying to bring Epstein up again. They said, this is a super desperation play on your part, and the only reason you think this is going to work is that what's really going on here is that the Democrats are making a play to the affluent white female liberal vote, which is pretty much their only firm vote now, the only 100% votes Democrat by 80% or whatever margins constituency they have left is the affluent white female liberal. And affluent white female liberals do not like Donald Trump at all. They hate him viscerally to the point where it's borderline a sickness. There are psychologists that are starting to talk about Trump derangement syndrome among some white women as if it was an actual mental disorder that requires treatment. They hate him so much. And so they are, that group of people is quite happy to hear the Democrats talk all day and all night about Jeffrey Epstein pimping out young girls for Donald Trump, whether there's any truth to it or not. And they don't really want to hear anything about Larry Summers or anybody else that Epstein had his claws into. They're quite happy. That group is quite happy to hear a story about how this is all about Donald Trump and nothing else, period. But they're pretty much the only ones that are buying what is being sold here. And the Democrats are backing themselves into some nasty corners by making these big, bold pronouncements that Trump needs to go and Trump needs to be arrested and everything else. And then it turns out Democrats were actually the ones doing that stuff with Epstein they're mad about, and they have to eat their words. That happened in real time over on CNN, which were the only entertainment left on CNN is when they bring Scott Jennings on. Scott Jennings is like the token conservative over there, and he just annihilates these liberals that CNN puts him on with. They outnumber him like 7-1, and he just cleans house like he was cleaning out a saloon in a Wild West fist fight. And he's up there talking to Anna Navarro, and she's pontificating about how the very fact that Donald Trump has been accused of having some email exchange or something with Jeffrey Epstein, or he called him on the phone once, you know, the very fact is just enough to be rid of Trump forever. And Scott Jennings says, well, you know, what about Larry Summers and Stacey Plaskett? And all of a sudden, Anna Navarro is like, well, that's bad too, but I don't want to talk about that. You know, she's backing up like in hysterics. And she goes back into her whole thing. This is their only avenue left for Democrats about how Trump has to resign and he has to be get gone. And every Republican linked to Epstein has to go. And Scott Jennings politely says, does that apply to Stacey Plaskett, who is a member of Congress? And she reluctantly says, well, okay, yeah, it applies to that. And he says, so should she resign? And Anna Navarro just loses her mind. There you go again, trying to bring Democrats in this. Bam, 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 bam. But I mean, that's the problem for you guys. Every time we start talking about Epstein, we get into Democrats. And as Jennings pointed out, the way he put it was that Epstein was literally programming Plaskett like she was a robot, you know, in his stable. She's telling her what to say in real time with text messages. How much more into Epstein's pocket could you possibly be that they have him using you as his mouthpiece? It's just amazing the way this scandal is blowing up. And meanwhile, you know, the rest of the country may be a little tired of Jeffrey Epstein one way or the other and would like to talk about other things. And that is sucking all the oxygen out of the room. There will be other things to talk about. Today, President Trump is meeting at the White House with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Mohammed bin Salman, who is the chief executive. Essentially, he runs Saudi Arabia. And he's at the White House for a meeting. First time he's traveled to the United States, to the White House, since the death of Jamal Khashoggi, which was a big scandal back in 5, 6, 7 years ago, where this writer was killed by Saudi agents in Turkey. And the Saudi government got in very bad odor, especially with people on the left in the Democratic Party. They were trying to turn that into a Trump scandal by saying Trump didn't respond forcefully enough to the accusations. Joe Biden, when he campaigned for president, he said he was going to turn Saudi Arabia into a global pariah. And he was going to turn Mohammed bin Salman into a global pariah, killing Jamal Khashoggi. And we all know that didn't work out because Joe Biden blew up the U.S. economy and ended up to keep the economy from melting down even further. So all of that pariah stuff went away right quick. And now Mohammed bin Salman is back in Washington And it's a big moment. It's a big moment for Saudi Arabia to try to reclaim some prestige that it might have lost with the international community, but also a big moment for Trump. He wants investments from the Saudis. He wants money to be put into the United States. He wants more cooperation with them in the region because they're a powerful regional ally. And he really, really wants them to join the Abraham Accords. If he could pull that off, that would be epic. I don't think he can, not right away, not today. But we're going to see what they have to say. They'll be finished talking in a couple of hours. And one of the big things on the agenda for Trump is building the Saudis into friends of Israel and realigning the Middle East. So that's a big play. And that's a lot more interesting, in my opinion, to talk about than whoever Jeffrey Epstein was driving around like a robot. But your mileage may vary. I'm John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News, your host today. We'll be right back with more of the Alan Nathan Show.
Next year marks America's 250th birthday, and what better way to celebrate than an elevated train journey through the American Southwest? Canyon Spirit offers the adventure of a lifetime with scenic train journeys through rugged canyons and desert landscapes, along with gourmet dining and world-class service. Expansive panoramic windows allow guests to watch the magnificent scenery best seen by rail, including river canyons, red rocks, and more. Canyon Spirit travels between Salt Lake City and Denver with overnight stays in Moab, Utah, and Glenwood Springs, Colorado. And the train only travels during the day, allowing guests to enjoy the journey and relax overnight in charming small towns. TV host and travel expert Kelly Rizzo.
I think there's a certain romance to boarding a train, especially through the iconic vistas of the Southwest. Canyon Spirit offers a front row seat to these breathtaking wonders along with historic storytelling and regionally inspired gourmet dining. It's truly a wondrous experience.
To learn more, visit canyonspirit.com.
Butterball, the best known and most loved brand of turkey in the U.S., has partnered with renowned Chef Corps brand Headley & Bennett to create the first ever Thanksgiving hosting pans. Butterball turkey talk line expert Corey Gustavik shares more.
Roasting whole turkey isn't something most of us do every day. It can be intimidating and stressful, but the right clothes can make you feel more confident and comfortable in the kitchen. That's why Butterball created the first of their kind Thanksgiving hosting pants. Designed with a fun turkey print in Butterball blue, these pants are sure to give you swagger in the kitchen while keeping all your cooking essentials within arm's reach. With custom pockets for your meat thermometer and phone, loops for your utensils and towels, and a bottle opener to keep the party hydrated, these pants will help you get a leg up in your hosting duties this year. Butterball is giving away for free one final time while supplies last at noon Eastern this Monday, November 17th.
Learn more and claim your pair of hosting pants at ThanksgivingHostingPants.com.
Adopt U.S. Kids for multiple choice parenting.
Your daughter just had her first breakup. Do you A, put yourself in her shoes?
How could he do this to you? And for Sheila, she has split ends.
B, console her.
Oh, sweetie, this is going to happen a lot. 4, maybe 5 more times before you get married.
C, take charge.
Got to get this all straightened out. Give a little talking to man, mano a mano. Hey, Steve. It's now a good time? No? Okay, no problem. Bye.
Or D, help her find a new boyfriend.
I know a great place to meet boys. The internet. Nice, single boys. Never mind. How about some ice cream?
As a parent, there are no perfect answers. But you don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same.
For more information on how you can adopt, visit AdoptUSKids.org, a public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
The mission of Paralyzed Veterans of America is clear. Accessibility. Veterans who have served and sacrificed the best of themselves deserve access to the best our country has to offer. Access to meaningful employment. Access to the veterans' benefits they've earned, accessible homes and vehicles, and access to every part of their communities. With PVA staff working inside VA hospitals, no other veterans organization has provided more real-time, ongoing support for paralyzed veterans and their families. PVA is proud to serve veterans across all branches, all generations, and all conflicts. Our nation's heroes fought for your independence. Join PVA in fighting for theirs. at pva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your guest host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor with Breitbart News. President Donald Trump says that he is now willing to meet with New York City Mayor-elect Zohra Mamdani. In fact, Trump said Mamdani reached out to him and wants to have a meeting. They have not had anything good to say about each other up until now, to put it mildly. But Trump says he wants the best for New York. He wants to work things out. And we will have to see if they can have a meeting of the minds and pull that off. Here with us to talk about it is John Gordon, national political analyst and host of the syndicated radio show, The Truth with John Gordon. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
Good afternoon, John. Nice to be with you.
You would have to think this would be an awkward conversation because Trump has dismissed Mamdani as a wild for jihad communist, and Mamdani thinks Trump is the focus of all evil in the modern world. But now they're going to go sit down and work things out. That's going to be quite a conversation, isn't it?
Well, I think it's probably pretty textbook Donald Trump, frankly. I mean, if you saw his interactions with the head of North Korea, otherwise known as Rocket Man, there was a lot of words were exchanged before he had his meeting with Kim Jong-un, and then they walked away with a relationship. And isn't that what we really need and want our leaders to do? I mean, they don't have to agree on things, but they can at least have a relationship so they can talk in a civil way. And maybe the conversation should be, on what do we agree?
That's a good point, you know, and eventually practicality overrides all else. You're talking about New York, which is a very important city with a lot going on there. Trump is from New York, so you really can't just freeze New York out of the federal government or vice versa. But it seems like these days, one of the problems I see is that these activist states, especially like sanctuary states and so on, they do want to essentially say, we're not going to participate in the federal government because we don't like who the president is and we don't like that our party lost the last election. So we're going to basically run things our own way down here, but we still expect all you federal taxpayers to fund us.
Well, I would ask, if I were Donald Trump, do you believe in the United States Constitution? And what do you have to say about that little factoid known as the Supremacy Clause? I mean, either we're going to be a country of laws and rule, or we're going to be anarchist. And I would submit that saying that you're going to defy the federal government would be very close to anarchy, if not by definition.
And I have no doubt that when this meeting takes place, and probably already, the press is going to say this is a huge win for Mamdani because Trump is agreeing to talk to him, is taking him legitimately now, you know, and is walking back some of his most extreme criticism of him. And Mamdani has yet to really make any concessions towards Trump other than saying he wants to work with the federal government.
Well, Mamdani's options are pretty limited, really. I mean, so much of his rhetoric is not compatible with New York state law. So what is he going to flick off the state government as well? I just think that what he said to get elected will not probably be his guiding light when he is required to govern, because he lacks the power to do so. Rents, they're controlled by the rent control board. The cost of transit is governed by the transit authority. I mean, you can just go down the list. And sure, he's got a soapbox, but that's where it really pretty much begins and ends on most of the things that he's promised.
Well, it's interesting that during the campaign, a lot of the Democratic Party establishment was quietly signaling to sort of anti-moderate Democrat voters in New York that a lot of the crazy stuff Mamdani says, he can't do it, he knows it won't work, it's just boob bait, and once he gets elected, no, he's not going to set up government grocery stores or any of the really nutty ideas he was promulgating. But then after he won the election, Kathy Hochul, the governor of New York, couldn't wait more than 48 hours to come out and say, oh yeah, I'm going to work with him, and if he needs money for all of his schemes, I'll make sure he gets it.
And there is the wild card. I think that to some extent, Kathy Hochul might play into the hand of Elise Stefanik, who is not a uncredible candidate for governor of New York. You may recall that in the last cycle, the Republican came within 5 points, I believe, of beating Hochul. So it'll be interesting to see where the demographics actually are today, because there has also been an exodus from New York, from people that don't like the taxes and don't like the bureaucracy and the rules. And I would suspect that most of those people are not Hochul supporters. And so that Dem plus five number may actually have shifted more in favor of the Democrats. Fact is, I just don't know. It'll be interesting to see.
Well, of course, a lot of people are expecting quite the exodus out of New York. We already are seeing some people getting out while the getting is good, because they don't want any part of what Mamdani is going to do to the city. But across the nation, Republicans in general have a bit of a problem with the urban vote. They seem to have a lot of trouble penetrating some of these big cities that are just Democrat fiefdoms. It doesn't matter who they run. It doesn't matter if they're an obvious lunatic. It doesn't matter if they don't know anything about government. It doesn't matter if they're a communist. It doesn't matter if they want to globalize the Intifada. Democrats just plain win in big cities, period. And the Republicans can't even make a run of it.
That is an undeniable truth. And the fact is, in a democracy, our representatives represent the views of their constituents. And so we talk about Mamdani, but how about the 2 million people that voted and elected him? And so I think he reflects their views and their wishes. And that is a big concern of mine, because I don't think the real contest today is between Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives. I'm sensing that it's more between the haves and the have-nots. And Lyndon Johnson started his great society in 1964. And boy, we're seeing what results of that are today.
Well, and that's a big problem. One of the things that you see a lot of Republican exponents saying about the election in New York is that Mamdani really worked well on the fears and anxieties that young people in particular have about the cost of living, that they can't make ends meet, they can't afford food, they can't afford rent. His whole message was affordability, which he's going to solve with magic pixie dust from the sky and communist funny money and so on. But I mean, that is a real anxiety people have. And I think there's a fear that if you don't address that anxiety, that you could have a snake oil salesman win anywhere by saying, oh, yeah, I'm just going to tax billionaires and give you free stuff, and that's how I'll solve your cost of living anxiety.
I think that's spot on, and I don't know what the anecdote for that is, frankly. I think that, you know, if there is a mass exodus out of New York, it's not going to be from the people that are living off the state. It will be the people who are funding the state. And the whole system does have the potential of snowballing in a very negative way, and you could end up ruining the greatest city in the world. And that is the fear that we should all be concerned about.
That is a very prescient warning. Detroit was always the horror story of that happening in a collapse, but Chicago is in pretty bad shape. They're jacking up all kinds of taxes like crazy there right now, and some of them are deliberately designed, it seems, to drive. So these blue cities are going to implode, and it's not going to be pretty to watch. John Gordon, national political analyst and host of the syndicated radio show The Truth with John Gordon. Thanks for joining us. I'm John Hayward, your host today. We'll be right back with more of The Alan Nathan Show.
Hilton has once again been ranked number one on the world's best workplace list, according to Great Place to Work and Fortune. The hospitality leader has now topped the list twice in 3 years. At Hilton, its team members say the hospitality industry is where they can learn, grow, and achieve their career goals. Victoria, a sales director at a Homewood Suites property, explains.
Hospitality is the warmest industry that you can go into. The care, the nurturing, and the areas of opportunity are large. There are so many different elements in hospitality, and I don't think everyone thinks about the larger picture that they could fit into. Hilton has always been just a welcoming, open-armed, flexible place to work. I'm going to look forward in enjoying more stable work days and the ability to just have that work-life balance that I truly want.
To learn more about what makes Hilton a great place to work, visit stories.hilton.com/worldsbestworkplace.
Small businesses face constant security challenges, from protecting property to keeping employees and customers safe. Simply Safe is stepping in with a new suite of professional-grade security solutions designed specifically for business owners. TV host and entrepreneur Chip Wade has more.
As a business owner, I travel a lot for work, and it's reassuring to have a system that not only lets me monitor my businesses no matter where I am, but it's protected by trained agents who will intervene if there's trouble. It's about knowing my offices and workshops are protected even when I can't be there.
Simply Safe Business Security offers customizable plans backed by 24/7 monitoring. Key features include AI-powered cameras, live agents who can help prevent crimes and call for help in an emergency, multi-camera live streaming, customized user access, and elevated customer support.
Simply Safe aims to give business owners just like me peace of mind so they can focus on growing their businesses, all without long-term contracts or cancellation penalties.
To learn more, visit simplysafe.com.
Hi, it's Practical Polly's radio show. If you're just figuring out that healthier cooking oils are better than solid fats, you may be asking, now what am I going to do with all these tubs of lard? Ever had one of those moments when your favorite skinny jeans feel too tightly tailored? Generously apply lard to your hips and thighs and those fancy pants will slide on like a dream. Or here's a family-friendly idea. How about making your yard into a lard fun park? Frost your driveway with a nice thick coating and give those kiddos a downhill thrill no matter what time of year. Having a bad hair day? Yep. A little lump of lard can tame your flyaways in a jiffy. So there's no need for that lard to go to waste or to your waste. But get your best heart-healthy trade-up with healthier oils like canola, olive, or other vegetable oils, which can actually lower your chances for heart disease. Now that's a tip worth keeping for life. Learn more at heart.org/facethefats. Canola Info is the national supporter of the American Heart Association's Face the Fats campaign.
Steven.
Who said that?
Me, down here.
What are you, a yellow booger?
I'm a banana slug, Steven.
Well, what are you doing in my room?
I'm your sense of adventure. Don't you remember me? Don't you know that we miss you?
Miss me? Who misses me?
You know, all your friends in the forest. The trees, the pond, that little fort that you made out of branches. We all miss you.
Mom took me to the forest last year.
I'm a slug, Steven. It took me a long time to get here.
Oh, I guess that makes sense.
The forest is not that far away. Have an adventure today. I'm sure your mom would take you.
You're right. I should get out. I want to have fun. Play in puddles, catch frogs, and climb trees. Hey, Mom!
Yeah, hon?
Steven! What is that in your hand?
It's my sense of adventure, Mom. It's telling me we need to get out of the house and have some fun in nature today.
Come to the forest where the more adventurous you lives. Check out discovertheforest.org for cool places nearby. Brought to you by the U.S. Forest Service and the Ad Council.
No word in the English language is less convincing than probably.
Are you sure we should get matching tattoos on our first date?
Sure. We'll probably stay together.
Probably? It's been 23 minutes since I ate. I can probably swim.
You should wait 30 minutes.
Okay, now tell me what to do. Cannonball! Cramp! Oh, I have a cramp. I can probably hit the green from here.
Probably.
Can I get a mulligan?
Ready to go?
Hey, are you sure you're okay to drive?
Yeah, I'm pretty sober. Yeah, I'm probably okay.
Probably okay isn't okay, especially when it comes to drinking and driving. If you're drinking, call a cab, a car, or a friend. Buzz driving is drunk driving. A message brought to you by NHTSA and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. Before the break, I was talking about Chicago tax increases. You got out of this to understand how bad this is. Chicago is the latest example of a blue state, blue Democrat-run type of city, where they're just desperately running out of money because their wild-eyed spending has driven them into a ditch. And now they're trying to claw every nickel, dime, and dollar they can get out of the people who live there. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for anybody who isn't a millionaire to live in the city. And even if you are, you're not going to be a millionaire for very long if you live in Chicago. So just off the top, Chicago property owners are about to get hit with the biggest property tax jump in 30 years that they face. Their property taxes are blowing into orbit to the point where smaller communities of disadvantaged people, less affluent communities, are pretty much throwing up their hands and saying, we can't pay these property taxes. What are you going to do to us if we can't pay what you're trying to extract out of us? Some of the minority activist groups in Chicago are saying that these tax increases proportionate to income are actually hitting the poor black neighborhoods hardest of anybody in the entire area. That, you know, those people literally can't pay what the government is about to demand of them. So it's just impossible. But that's not the end of it. That's the tip of the iceberg. There's still more. Chicago is bringing back its head tax. The head tax, that's a tax on your head. That is exactly what it is. Chicago had this crazy idea a while ago that they would put a special tax on businesses of a certain amount of money for every person you're employing. And it's pretty substantial. It's a lot of money per employee that every business would have to pay. And of course, businesses said, I'm not going to pay that. And they left Chicago. So they abolished the head tax in 2014. But now they're bringing it back, and their genius idea to camouflage this cash grab is to rename it and say that it's now a community safety surcharge. See, you have to pay a certain amount of money for everybody who works in your company because Chicago has to keep them all safe from the rampant crime the Democrat Party has unleashed on every square inch of the city. So if you employ 500 people, you got to pay the city big bucks extra to keep your 500 people from getting mugged by all the criminals Democrats have put on the streets. So that's their head tax. That's coming back. They also have a tax that only they have in the entire United States called the cloud tax. It's not a tax on actual clouds. It's a tax on cloud data, which is possibly even funnier and more ridiculous. But they have a tax, currently 9%, it's going up, on cloud data, electronically delivered or cloud-hosted software. And they're the only city that has this. But of course, that has been a signal to the cloud networking community to stay the hell out of Chicago, because if you run anything there or base anything there, they're going to tax the dickens out of you. And then they have another tax that they have that applies to some of the same people. That's their entertainment tax or their amusement tax. And a while ago, they decided they were going to expand it to include social media. And that's going into effect now. And it's a tax of 50 cents per active user over 100,000 that a social media company has in Chicago. That could be a lot of money for a lot of social media endeavors. Online games, I guess, would have to be covered by this because they are online communities as well. So, I mean, that's 50 cents for every user over 100,000. Some of these services have millions of users. And I guess it's only going to be users in Chicago. But that naturally would then invite the question of how do you police that? So they're going to have a whole bureaucratic apparatus that makes sure you're paying the proper entertainment tax for everybody that's being entertained on your social media platform. And, you know, the logical response of most companies, maybe not right away, but eventually, is going to be to charge more if you live in Chicago to recoup the cost of this tax. So if you want to play Roblox or whatever in Chicago, you're going to have to pay extra because they have to pay the social tax or entertainment tax that they're applying. So, I mean, these taxes are deranged and there's no end to it in sight. All of those taxes I mentioned are either new or going up right now if you're in Chicago, and it's going to keep happening. You're going to have more taxes next year and they'll go up again and more the year after that. And one of the reasons why is that when these blue cities go berserk with taxes and start squeezing all this money out of people, well, people leave. You know, you don't have to live in that city. You don't have to go that far to get out of the city, really. You don't have to move to Mars or anything to escape from Chicago's taxing authority. So people leave and businesses leave and people with money take their money and they go. And this is the death spiral that is afflicting a lot of big cities in the country. And I suspect it's going to afflict even more of them as times come. And in the red states, the lower tax states, they've been taking advantage of this by enticing people to move there. So, for example, right now, Florida, which is where I live, has long been a place where Northeasterners, New Yorkers, they flee to Florida to get away from the state that they come from. And they find happiness in lower taxes. And we don't have an income tax No state income tax in Florida, so that's nice. But now the governor, Ron DeSantis, has been pushing to eliminate property taxes, which is an interesting argument. There's quite an intriguing debate to be had about whether they're necessary or whether they're even ethical. Why should the government be able to tax you forever on a property that you paid for a long time ago and have no intention of selling anytime in the near future? See, a property tax, legally speaking, a property tax is almost like a tax on a phantom sale you haven't made yet. They assess the value of your property, and then they tax it as if you were going to sell it tomorrow, but you're not. You're going to live there. You've been there forever. You're going to live there forever. They don't care. You're still going to pay the property tax. And people for many years have been complaining that that, in essence, means that nobody really ever owns property. The government is always the owner of last resort, I guess you could say, for every square inch of property in the country, because if you don't pay the property taxes at various levels, you'll lose it. They'll take it away from you. So whatever else they let you do with it, you still got to pay your tax. So DeSantis is trying to get rid of the property tax. And if he succeeds, if that goes through, man, is that ever going to start a stampede from people that are selling out their properties in these high-tax blue states, trying to get away from this insanity that's going to be unleashed by people like Zora Mamdani. And then you find out there's no property tax in Florida. Well, hello, Florida. They're going to buy up every square inch of the place, as if that wasn't happening already. I mean, it's an interesting experiment in some ways, because this is really the way the country was supposed to work way back in ye olden times when the Constitution was being set up. The founding fathers were very big on federalism. And one of the reasons why they wanted a small central government and more powerful states and municipalities was exactly because it's more ethical that people can leave if they don't like what's happening. If you live in Chicago and you've had it up to here with the cloud tax, the entertainment tax, the head tax, the property tax, and the tax on your breathing and everything else, you can leave. And that is supposed to be the way the laboratory of democracy works. And it has eroded over the years. It doesn't really work that way quite as well anymore. One reason being that the federal government is now titanic beyond the worst sweaty nightmares of the founding fathers. You could kill those guys stone dead if you took a time machine and jumped back in time and popped into the Constitutional Convention and just spent 5 minutes describing how much money the current federal government spends. They'd all die of heart attacks on the spot. This is not what they thought they were building when they created this country. And one of the problems with having a huge, powerful, greedy, rich central government is that you can't get away from it. You can't just move somewhere and be protected from the depredations of the central government. But is that really true anymore? Because we have sanctuary cities. We have had some politicians, and I maintain this is brute totalitarianism. Everybody yells about no kings and authoritarianism. Sanctuary city is a pure authoritarian flex. That's the people in a city, the government of a city, saying, we don't like the federal immigration laws, and we can't win an election to change them, so we're just going to ignore them and help people to break them over here. I don't care what you think, how nice you think you are, by supporting that, you're an authoritarian if you think that's the way it needs to be done. And that has created the precedent that states can now override federal law. So maybe some states are going to start trying to override federal law on taxes, let's say. Maybe it's time we had a revolt and we had sanctuary cities for people that don't like complying with stupid federal laws, like Obamacare. Could we have a sanctuary city to get away from Obamacare? Because even the Democrats are admitting it's dying. They're giving these interviews ever since their shutdown blew up on them. And some of them are starting to grudgingly admit, yeah, it's in really deep trouble if we don't pour another $1 trillion of subsidies into this scheme. I mean, so can I maybe start a sanctuary city where nobody has to pay for Obamacare and we can have a real healthcare system and good insurance? Why not? If you can do it for sanctuary cities, why not for that? I mean, the sky's the limit if we're going to set the precedent that individual states and counties and cities and whatnot can just decide not to play along with laws they disapprove of. I mean, it seems like that's a recipe for anarchy in the end, which doesn't seem like a good idea to me. But if that's the only way to escape from overbearing federal authority, I think more people are going to explore it. I wouldn't be surprised if we start seeing sanctuary cities for federal gun laws, if they get out of control in the future and people start saying, no, we're not going to comply with those stupid laws. We'll have our own. So, I mean, I think the ultimate answer to this is to have a less powerful central government and make it so you don't have to do sanctuary city theatrics in a lot of ways. But, you know, immigration policy is one of the things the federal government does have to take care of because there's only one border. So, you know, it's an interesting conversation. But in the meantime, I think the exodus out of these high-tax states is going to continue, and that's going to be trouble for everybody in the future. I'm John Hayward, your host today. We'll be right back with more of The Alan Nathan Show.
Would you know where to turn if you or loved one suddenly became paralyzed? Paralysis isn't something you plan for, but the National Paralysis Resource Center has served as a vital lifeline for thousands of families. But federal funding for the program is at risk. Marine veteran Sherman Gillums Jr., Senior Director of Public Policy at the Christopher and Dana Reeve Foundation, says the consequences could be devastating.
This is about more than just a budget line. It's about veterans, caregivers, and families, real people who need these resources to live more productive and independent lives.
Gillums, who lives with paralysis himself, says cutting this funding would remove critical resources like peer mentoring, help with housing, and job placement guidance.
When you take away these lifelines, people must figure out how to rebuild their lives on their own. And that's not something any family should have to do.
Learn about the importance of funding for the National Paralysis Resource Center at ChristopherReeve.org.
On Sunday, November 2nd, Americans will fall back to standard time, despite growing concerns over the health and safety risks of seasonal time changes. According to sleep experts, making standard time permanent could improve the lives of millions, and the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time and its partner, the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, are working to make that a reality. Dr. Karen Johnson, sleep medicine physician and co-chair of the Coalition for Permanent Standard Time.
When our schedules align with the timing of natural light, people benefit from brighter mornings, safer commutes to work and school, and improved sleep at night.
Want to lessen the effects of the time change? Try these tips. Get at least 7 hours of sleep per night before and after the change. Adjust the timing of daily routines like meals and exercise, and head out for early morning sunlight during the week after the time change. For more information about ending daylight saving time and to find additional resources about sleep disorders, treatments, and sleep health, visit sleepeducation.org. Sponsored by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine.
Dear John, I was hoping it wouldn't come to this, but you've left me no choice. I'm leaving. Uncontrolled high blood pressure is really serious, and lately you seem to really not care. I've been there for you since day one, and I know you think I'm going to keep ticking. But no, my friend, I can quit whenever I want. Why can't we get back to the good times, when we were more active and ate more healthy foods, and you checked on me every once in a while? Is that too much to ask? I don't want to leave, but unless you stop ignoring me, what else am I supposed to do? Remember, when I quit, you quit. Sincerely, your heart.
Listen to your heart and don't let it quit on you. Doing the minimum to control your high blood pressure isn't doing enough. High blood pressure can lead to a stroke, heart attack, or death. Get your blood pressure to a healthy range before it's too late. For help keeping yours at a healthy range, text PRESSURE to 97779. A message from the American Heart Association, the American Stroke Association, and the Ad Council.
You know that feeling? Like every door is closing and you just can't see a way out? Being unemployed, underemployed, or just out of school feels a lot like that. But when you find the right tools, suddenly, everything just clicks. Getting on that path may be easier than you think. A good place to start? Go to findsomethingnew.org. At findsomethingnew.org, you have access to resources that help develop new skills. Skills that will position you for careers in today's growing industries. From healthcare and manufacturing to cybersecurity and alternative energy. Plus, you can take advantage of online courses, certification programs, apprenticeships, and more. So you can take yourself from unemployed and uncertain to empowered and prepared for what's next. Find your path to a new career today. Visit findsomethingnew.org. A message from the Ad Council.
I'm Ben Affleck, and I want to thank you for joining me and supporting Paralyzed Veterans of America. Our vets need you.
I'm a quadriplegic. I'm definitely at risk with my diminished lung capacity.
I have MS. I'm in a wheelchair and I can't leave the house because I have a compromised immune system.
I'm very concerned about, would there be a bed for me? Would there be a ventilator for me? Would I be able to survive something?
It's just heavy. You know, it's a heavy moment.
This is a war. This really is.
Our veterans fought for us. Let's fight for them.
I am so grateful for the PVA. They're making sure that we have all of the food and supplies that we need right now.
We all gotta help each other right now.
We can't get through this by ourselves.
It's with profound gratitude that you're going to be saving our lives.
To find out how you can help, please go to helppva.org. That's helppva.org.
Welcome back to the Alan Nathan Show. I'm your host today, John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News. President Donald Trump promised that in his first year, he would cut the price of energy by 50%. And while he's made great strides to improving America's energy output, electricity prices are still going up, and he's running out of time if he wants to make good on his promise. And our next guest has some ideas for how he can do it. Joining us now is Chet Love, Republican strategist and co-founder of Cornerstone Group International. Welcome to the Alan Nathan Show.
It's a pleasure, John. I love reading your articles, man.
Well, thank you very much. Very nice of you to say. The clock is ticking on Trump's first year, running out of time to make that energy promise. What can he do to bring it home?
Well, what we know, number one, is that we've seen across the country that overall fuel prices have come down, but electricity prices on average across the country are going up. So we got to find more ways to increase more supply of electrons on the grid and to improve our energy efficiency with the electrons that we already have that are going out on the grid.
And your contention, I see from the article you have at the Washington Examiner, is that solar power would be a big part of that because you can build solar capacity very quickly, and he could get enough of it online to meet his promise.
Yeah, and I know for a lot of people sitting at home, you're like, oh my God, what are you doing talking about renewables? But listen, President Trump had issues with Elon Musk. They figured it out. You had President Trump, he's having some issues with Marjorie Taylor Greene. They're going to figure it out. And President Trump has had some issues with the renewable energy industry. But here's the thing. What we need right now is as many electrons put on the grid as possible, as quickly as we can. And with wind and solar, those are the only types of facilities that we can put up in a year that we can get out electrons by 2026 in these midterms to get those prices down so that, again, we can compete in the midterms. Because everything about the 2026 midterms is going to be about affordability.
Now, I think by the process of elimination, you could say that pretty much every other form of grid electrical generation would just take much, much longer than that to get permitted and constructed. Is that right?
Absolutely. I believe in an all of the above strategy. We should be drilling, baby, drill. But we got to look at everything else, and we got to figure out how do we do it as quickly as possible. And again, the numbers just prove themselves. You got to add some renewables and solar and wind to this mix.
Now, how would you envision these being built? Would these be solar farms and wind farms, that kind of thing? Or are you thinking of individual homeowners putting up solar panels and that sort of thing, or both?
I think you got to do both. I think, look, one of the most American things you could actually do is to be able to say you want to generate your own power. Every single American should be empowered to be in control of their own electricity destiny. And so being able to empower the average everyday homeowner to be able to produce their own electricity at home makes a ton of sense. That's very American. But also we need large-scale industrial facilities. I was just out in rural Utah, and they have these huge solar plants all over that are helping not only to benefit the state, but then that electricity is going all around the grid to benefit other states that are struggling in meeting their current energy demands for everyday consumers.
You also advocated energy efficiency measures. What did you have in mind there?
Well, what we see in terms of things like heat pumps and other energy efficiency measures, you have organizations like the Alliance to Save Energy that's been doing a ton of work around this to, again, help support the president in terms of meeting this goal of reducing the cost for everyday Americans. And it's simple things, like in terms of conservation, but in terms of also policies that are going to allow for individuals in the homes to reduce their overall usage and utilization, and also improving the rates that you see at the utility commissions in terms of how they deal with demand response, how they deal with peaks and lows during the rest of the day. Those are also things that I think people should be looking at and taking a look at.
You mentioned electrical prices are increasing or spiking. What is causing that? What's the big driver of increasing electricity prices right now?
AI, the AI race, we got to beat China. And every single electron that's on the grid right now, it needs to be allocated to, again, beating China. But we still have, you know, your average everyday electricity usage, but we still need the regular electrons to keep the lights on. And so, again, we have increasing demand, but we don't have the supply. And just like anybody knows from a basic econ class, the more demand you have, the less supply, the price is going to go up. So the only way that we really can, again, drive prices down is we got to have more supply.
And this is a point I like to bring up all the time when we talk about energy needs. People do not realize how much energy AI consumes. Those AI server farms are just power hogs beyond belief. And I think in the long term, solar, wind, and so on might help us in the short term to meet that Trump promise. But in the long term, that's not going to cut it. We're going to need a lot of power to fuel AI the way it's being imagined right now.
Tons. I mean, when most people think about it today, you do a simple Google search. That actually takes up electricity, right? You got to use the servers, it uses other things in the internet that is all powered by electricity. A simple AI query takes about 10 times that amount of electricity just for a simple search. And so, again, the amount of electricity that the average consumer is going to be using now that we have AI, and now that many other things are becoming electrified, is going to increase substantially, and we have to find ways to produce more electricity. And that has to be at the residential level and the commercial level all across the board. We got to generate more electricity.
Well, there's huge potential spike in energy demand to come, which would be electric vehicles. If they ever really catch on the way people were hoping they would, that's going to dramatically increase electrical demands to the point where the current grid just can't handle it.
Yeah, what people don't even realize is that it's not just about pure EV, because a lot of people are now going to hybrids. And so you're having a hybrid between having part electric, part gas, and most of the major auto manufacturers have talked about creating more hybrids. And so when you have these hybrid vehicles, they also need electricity. And so, yeah, that demand is going to increase substantially on a megawatt and terawatt basis.
Is hybrid really the way to go? I've heard people saying that the only reason the big automakers are now talking hybrids is that none of them can get EVs to work the way they wanted to. They poured a bunch of money into them. Nobody's buying them. Tesla's the only company that's really making money on EVs, and even there, it's a little shaky right now.
Yeah, look, I think at the end of the day, it should be about Americans choosing what vehicle they want. Nobody wants to have anything forced down your throat. If somebody wants to have a gas hog, great. If somebody wants to have a pure EV, awesome. At the end of the day, hybrids are a fantastic solution for a lot of people.
And I think hybrids also would have the advantage of not requiring quite as much of a radical change to our electrical grid as going to an all-EV future would imagine. But between that, EVs and AI, and the future of energy consumption is a whole new world that I don't think we're quite ready for just yet. Chet Love, Republican strategist and co-founder of the Cornerstone Group International. Thanks very much for joining us. I'm John Hayward, Deputy National Security Editor for Breitbart News, your host today. Thanks for joining us on this hour of the Alan Nathan Show.
The opinions you hear on the Main Street Radio Network are those of the host, callers, and guests, and not necessarily those of the station, Main Street Radio Network, its management, or advertisers. The information on the Main Street Radio Network does not constitute a recommendation, offer, or solicitation to buy or sell any product or securities. So please, consult a professional before investing. If you have any questions or comments about Main Street Radio Network, contact us at 703-719-0433 or at our website, mainstreetradionetwork.com.